Welcome, everybody, to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. God, I nearly said Trader Talk TV there. Kieran, still trying to steal your thunder. There's a little giveaway to one of our guests. But I want to introduce our first very special guest for this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast, Matt Barash, SVP Strategy and Business Development for Ad Colony. Matt, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, guys, today.
Not at all. Our pleasure. And from ExchangeWire, from very nearby, hunkered down in his apartment near ExchangeWire HQ, Kieran O'Kane. How are you doing,
Hello.
Kieran?
Hello.
How's things going?
Going great.
Okay. Looking a little bit wooden there. I've got no idea why.
It's very odd doing these podcasts like this, so I'm still getting used to it.
Okay. And what did I say about the headphones there? No, no touching of them because it makes a crinkly noise. Oh, listeners, you must love the Mad Tech Podcast. Right, I'm diving straight in. First story of the week I wanted to chat about was the IPA here in the UK. So that, for anyone that isn't familiar with the IPA, the Institute of Practitioners in Advertising, has released their Q1 bellwether report. It is what it says, designed to be a little bit of a bellwether for the health of the industry from the perspective of marketers and brands and advertisers, talking specifically about what their marketing intentions might be for the coming quarter, called Q2, but also looking back and reviewing what they did in Q1 and giving a little bit of perspective on their confidence in terms of a financial outlook. No surprises here that this report fed back that there's been a significant drop in spend in Q1. We all know that. But specifically, they point to it being the fastest rate of decline since the 2008 global financial crisis. And there's been a few other sort of industry reports that have come out over the last week saying something similar, I guess, because we're getting to that phase of Q2 where everybody's done their Q1 analysis and are able to really speak with some confidence about what's been happening here. So I wanted to touch on this and get some thoughts from both of you on it. What I specifically wanted to note was that we published a post in ExchangeWire last week asking for a bit of industry commentary and feedback on this to get people's perspective on the findings in the Q1 report and also to just try to get them to put it in a bit of context for their businesses. So some of the things that I wanted to highlight was, there's obviously lots of opinions around how brands should be navigating their way through this particular period of crisis, particularly from a spend point of view, and that it's important for them to not be absent. Of course, that depends greatly on what kind of businesses they're running. There's also a bit of commentary around the decline in ad spend from some brands, particularly those really big CPG brands. I think Coca-Cola is a prominent one that's come out saying that they were pausing all of their marketing and advertising spend. And one of the commentators in our write-up of this was saying, is this an indication actually of how marketing is perceived in that company as, a sort of a cost versus an investment? And there's also lots of commentary about how, okay, things are bleak and certainly became very bleak at the end of Q1, aren't looking really great at the moment in Q2. But is the backdrop of this that it's actually putting us in a position of fueling innovation and creativity because it's demanding that businesses be more adaptable than they've ever had to be before? Lots of commentary about the potential for developing new tech solutions and tech tools in this time as technology vendors get a bit closer to specifically what it is that brands need right now and can really see what brands are making use of in terms of tech tools. And also a little bit of optimism around the opportunities for those brands and advertisers that can afford to keep going with some of their marketing and advertising spend in an environment which is arguably a little bit less noisy and less crowded than before. Plenty of other things we could touch on there, but that's just a sort of a short summary. Matt, I wanted to come to you in the first instance to get your perspective on this. Obviously, it's a UK-based report, but I think it's got some findings that will resonate very strongly for you over there in the US, and I know you've got a global perspective anyway. So what's your point of view on some of these findings?
For sure. There's a lot to unpack there, right? And I think this is, I hate to call it like everybody else, unprecedented timing. And so, when you look at Q1 of 2020, it was really sort of a tale of two cities, right? You had January and February, which looked pretty good for most people, and then March fell off a cliff. And as COVID and the coronavirus started to sort of escalate, I think, you went through a phase of initial shock and then, people kind of coming to grips globally, and depending on where you were geographically, you know, the impact was, you know, was felt in different ways. And so as you look at the effect across the media industry, I think what you're starting to see is a little bit of reinvention. And you're starting to see, you know, to me, this common theme of we're all learning together. So whether you're an advertiser or marketer, whether you're a media company, whether you're a vendor or anyone in between who partakes in the marketing and advertising ecosystem, in some way, shape, or form, you're trying to understand the current climate, what the values are and the motivations of consumers and marketers. You're trying to drive the right actions if you're a marketer. And you're really trying to, more than anything, understand this massive seismic shift in consumer behavior, which we've never seen anything like it. And so when I start to look at and really sort of analyze what Q1 looked like, you know, I think it's really tough to suggest that marketers are one size fits all entity. And there will be winners, there will be losers. And you know, there are certain companies that will come out of this smelling like a rose. And there will others that probably will never come back. It is a really unique situation. So what does that mean? First and foremost, I think if I'm a marketer today, I'm very sensitive. I'm incredibly sensitive to my messaging. I'm really thinking about the tone and what I'm out there saying to my consumers and what do my consumers want to hear. If I'm an agency, I'm thinking about how do I take this consultative approach to my client to help them recognize what their position should be in market and how to best take advantage or leverage some of those changes in consumer behavior and media consumption to navigate and really direct and steer messaging appropriately. And then if I'm a consumer, what do I want to hear? And who do I want to hear from? And what's important to me? And so when you take all of those variables and you kind of put them in the blender and you put it all together and you hit, you know, hit the button, what's the output? And the output is very much to be determined, right? And so, you know, I think the surprising or the results that have been shared in terms of Q1 shouldn't surprise anyone. It's Q2 that's going to be the really, that's going to be the benchmark for the health of the advertising economy. I think it's really interesting to think about, you know, lots of buzzwords that people started the year, right, with predictions talking about, right? Transformational agencies, you know, marketers thinking about, you know, how they're going to approach their omni-channel strategy. And today they really have to do so in a far faster way than I think ever expected. So really what we're saying is we're all learning on the fly, right? We are very much kind of testing, iterating, changing, being fluid, and, you know, and trying to do our best, but there's no such thing as perfection.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, you raise a really good point, actually, Matt, which is that, you know, and I didn't touch on this to start with because, you know, what we were looking at was sort of an output report, but as you rightly point out, you know, it's worth reflecting what's going into that, which is this seismic change in consumer behavior. And, you know, as you also, you know, rightly point out, the really interesting bit is going to be what happens next, because, you know, massive change in consumer behavior certainly impacted a bit of Q1, but what the hell is Q2 going to look like? And, you know, we're really operating in a bit of an unknown environment. Kieran, what's your point of view? You're on mute as well, by the way. Shame you're not on mute more often. Joe?
You know, as Sam Cook said, a change is going to come. You know, this crisis, unexpected, as Matt said, like, you know, totally left field, is going to shake up the industry in so many ways. You know, there's going to be companies that kind of like get leaner, meaner, stronger, and there are companies that go out of business. But what will emerge from this is probably a far stronger industry going forward. And it's kind of like, it's kind of like one of those, you know, those civilization destroying events, like, you know what I mean? It's just sort of like, you could end this, you could argue this is sort of like the end of the programmatic decade, and what an ending it's going to be like, you know, like,
But are you saying there's going to be no more programmatic after this decade?
No, I never said that. I just said that the companies that you that are sort of, you know, populating the programmatic ecosystem are, were already in danger with the cookie changes, and now they've got an extra you know, financial obstacle in front of them.
Kieran, you're a delicate guy, right?
Yeah, I'm like a flower.
You don't break anything ever, right? I think what we're talking about is we're talking about an industry correction, right? But like, pardon me, it's fucked up.
Yeah,
it's going to absolutely reinvent an industry where if you don't provide value, you're going to be on the outside looking in.
You're gone
if you're lucky. Yeah. And you know, I think to your point, I think it's much needed, and this is just going to accelerate theme of consolidation that we're all expecting, but now it's going to come out of necessity.
Yeah, and the thing is, I think the best companies, best solutions come, as you say, out of necessity, right? And good people will be forced into thinking for the first time in 10 years, because I think we've become very lazy as an industry. It's become too easy, too complacent.
Yeah, so now, yeah, for sure.
Now we've got now we're like going, oh shit, there's no handy jobs in the ecosystem anymore. There's no one going to pay me £300,000 a year to swan around selling impressions or buying impressions or whatever. I actually now have to think, oh, okay, what value add can I introduce into the ecosystem that a marketer or a publisher really wants? And that's going to be an interesting place to be.
So in a way, you're almost saying that process that we've been talking about a lot, that a lot of businesses, not just in our industry, but sort of globally at the moment, are applying to the way they're structured, you know, making sure that they're as lean as they can possibly be, making sure they're focusing on the things they really need to be doing. You're saying that that principle is applying actually to our industry more broadly and to the programmatic ecosystem, actually, more specifically, that people are going to find themselves in a position of thinking, okay, you know, in terms of a business model, we've got to go for the things that are the most useful and the most important, the most critical things. And, you know, we can't sort of waste our time relying on things that have maybe made us easy revenue before in the past. We've actually got to go possibly down a tougher route to find something that's very relevant.
Yeah. And Rachel, it's just not an ad tech thing. This is a seismic transformational event across multiple industries, right? It doesn't just affect ad tech. It affects tech. It affects industries. It affects agencies. It affects wider than way beyond marketing, right? This is like, we've now, as an economy, being forced into a transformation event, right? Anybody who runs a business is going to have to rethink and rebuild what they do, because it's not bad. It's not going to be normal. Hours resumed, or you know, normal sort of practice resumed post COVID, and this is the thing I can't get my head around. People just assume that we'll snap back. I saw some numbers this morning from the IAB, I think it was the IAB, talking about declines in revenue, and then suddenly, magically, 2021, like, we're back up to double digit growth, like, you know, 21-25%. I was like, sitting there going. I'm not entirely sure that rosy picture is correct.
It's interesting. I noticed that as well. And I was wondering if it was a bit of a false positive, right? Because what you've got is, in terms of media, and there's something that is super fascinating to me, right? We just talked about a Q1 bellwether report and spend trends. And if you think about what's going on in terms of, you know, how people are spending their time and what's going on with, you know, I think just programming, right? Broadcast calendars are coming to the end of the year. But then, you know, you're probably about a month and a half, 2 months away from what would have been an Olympics, right? And when you remove the Olympics from the equation in 2020, and then you put it in 2021, does all of that spend and does all of that reporting that goes against it move to 2021 to create that sort of inflated number?
Yeah. And
Sorry, Ray, just to cut across there. It is interesting, Matt, just to follow on from your logic, that the industry seems to think that nothing has changed, where it has changed, right? This enforced lockdown is going to change habits across people and what they do and how they view, how they engage with media. And it is interesting. I would love to see the fallout from, you know, having no sports for 3-4 months of the year, or even more, like, you know. I mean, you've read probably about all the football leagues across Europe desperately trying to get back on, trying to get a summer season finished, or last season finished, by behind closed doors, because they've got you know, massive TV deals that they need to fulfill. But is that really going to happen? I don't know. And this is the thing. I think
you know, we're making assumptions that things will actually bounce back, and that also the things that we already know about being postponed to 2021 will carry on in a sort of business as usual fashion. So there's nothing to say that, you know, the Olympics will be delivered without any changes to the plan in 2021. You know, we're still so far away from knowing what all of that looks like, right?
And that's what's so fascinating to me about some of these forecasts and projections, because, you know, linear GRPs in the broadcast world have fallen off a cliff. Netflix consumption is, you know, like growing exponentially. It's incredible. And so for marketers, they're going to have to rethink their strategies, and they're going to have to look at things that, you know, they've never looked at before. For example, out of home, right? If we are all sitting at home all day, every day, that's an industry that's going to be challenged. The theatrical or the cinema advertising business, that's going to be challenged as well. Something as basic as just radio, right? What you listen to in your car. That today is probably struggling mightily. And so, you know, where will that potential consumption shift? It will, in all likelihood, shift digitally. But the question is where and who will the winners ultimately be?
And there is no doubt that the money, that offline money is coming, is going to go to digital. And as you say, Matt, where would it go? The other thing that I think the reports seem to kind of gloss over, which I find very disappointing, is the fact that the recession is going to change consumption habits dramatically. Certain high ticket sort of purchases will decrease. And in the recessionary period, you know, people tighten the belt, you know. And also, I think that the sad thing about a lot of these sort of these extraordinary unemployment rates is that I think that a lot of those people might stay unemployed, and that will have its own effect. And I think that will probably play into the hands of performance more than the branding piece. Anything that has a sort of a clear performance KPI, it could be brand as well. It doesn't have to be specifically performance. Will probably win in the new environment. I just think that it's going to be the survival of the fittest going forward. I think it's the people who can actually prove that their shit works, basically.
Mm. And like you said, though, the sort of movement to digital channels, because, you know, there are going to be some markets for which that will be quite a significant benefit. I'm thinking of, you know, Southeast Asia and other countries which are not as digitized, and other marketplaces that are not as heavily digitized in terms of advertising and marketing opportunities as, say, European and US markets. And also, I mean, I agree with what the two of you have just said there, but, you know, we are also hearing instances of, you know, as things are sort of returning to some sense of normality over in China, actually there's a little bit of evidence to suggest that some spend is going towards luxury goods. I mean, not, you know, house, I don't, I'm not, not sure it's a big house purchasing market anyway, but not maybe a Tesla, but, you know, some expensive luxury shopping is kind of coming back, which surprises me. And again, you know, maybe that is an economic discussion because maybe less people in China have lost their jobs and are still able to shop in those categories. And again, I think this just all points to it being rather unknown. We can make some predictions, but, you know, we're really, it's a bit like trying to stab jelly with a spoon, with a fork. You can't really get a measure of what's going on here. Kira's just looking
jelly
at me.
Stab jelly with a fork. Right,
Kira's looking at me. Matt's probably going, yeah, what the hell is she talking
that's
about?
That's how I'm occupying my time on Saturdays and Sundays when I've got nothing else to do now.
Nice. Yeah, good. Okay, I'm going to move us on to the second story of the week, which is news that German publisher and sales house Axel Springer has joined the European Net ID Foundation. Now, the European Net ID Foundation are a German sort of run-based publisher consortium. Trying to develop a single sign-on across a number of different publishing sites and assets. They've been in operation for a number of years. I think they were first set up in maybe 2016, 2017 maybe. But this is big news that Axel Springer have you know, formalised their involvement in the NetID Foundation. It's also big news because one of the things that they've sort of emphasised in the release of this news and information is that this is their quest to develop an identity solution for users across properties, publishing properties. That means that there doesn't need to be relying on Google and Facebook, and they're specifically looking to counteract the dominance that those companies have got in Europe more generally, and specifically in Germany. So some perspectives on this. Kieran, I know you're going to have big opinions on this. You're a big fan of anyone that's looking to take on the big G and the FB face-to-face. And I think you've also got really strong opinions about how publishers need to monetize their businesses and how they need to improve their sort of user data assets. And single sign-on is something that you've been keen on for a long time. So let me know what you think about this, and then I'll head to you, Matt. Kieran.
Well, it's just the way things are going to go. You know, this is the end of the third party cookie. So we are in a world of multiple walled gardens, you know? So why shouldn't the premium publishers in Germany have just, you know, their own walled garden? And sort of give advertisers a premium version of Facebook and Google. Like, let's be honest, Facebook and Google are dog shit inventory. Facebook specifically, like, it's just user generated nonsense from sociopathic individuals who just want to kind of like talk about their lives online. Idiots that they are.
Apologies to any listeners who are Facebook users.
No, you're a morons. Get off Facebook.
Now I know why you've never accepted my friend request. That makes sense.
So it makes a lot of sense. The only sort of caveat to this is Firefox and Safari, and whether or not these solutions will work cross-site on those environments. So Chrome, I suppose, is an exception for the minute. But what happens when we come into war where you can't do cross-site targeting? I'd be interested to see how the technology would work across the browsers, because Safari, when they saw the ReArc stuff that the IAB was trying to launch, which I believe is probably something similar.
In terms of single sign-on?
Well, it's not single sign-on specifically. It's more, you know, pseudonymization, if you will. I can't even pronounce that word.
Using
a token to identify a specific user across site. Maybe this is different because there's a sign in. I'm probably wrong there. So it's a sign in, I guess, across multiple sites. So that will work. But it makes a ton of sense. But then you got to have scale to make it work. You know what I mean? You kind of have to have, you know, not just Axel Springer, but most of the German market involved, which I believe is the case.
Well, exactly. So this is adding to, certainly, Gruner and Diar oh, and without it in front of me, I can't remember, a couple of other big German publishers, well-known German publishers.
Deutsche, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that they're trying to do exactly what you're talking about. And I think they're focusing on sign-on rather than some kind of token.
Yeah, tokens won't work. Tokens won't work across sites. So if it's sign in, I just got confused myself. If it's just sign on, then it would work pretty well. Mm. But then obviously they have to opt the user into ads as well. Which that's fair enough. That's an easier process when you've got them signed in, you know. But if they're using it as a token based system, they're gonna fall over, particularly with Safari and Firefox. And Firefox has got like a 35% market share in Germany desktop.
Yeah, it's heavily used in Germany. Yeah.
So I think a single sign-on, and if they could serve the ads on a first-party basis, would be they'd be away to the races, basically.
Yeah, well, it's quite possible that that's the position they're in. Matt, what's your point of view on this? Because I'm wondering if it works, as we've just sort of outlined, if it's something that can work across browsers and so forth. Do you think it could be an inspiration to other markets where publishers are really looking to, you know, own their own customer data?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. First and foremost, I know a lot more about Axl Rose than Axel Springer over here, but
nice.
We know how things went for Guns N' Roses, right? And that like band broke up.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when it comes to consortiums, I think that it's a really tough thing to pull off.
Yeah.
And what you're trying to do is you're trying to herd cats, right? You've got a bunch of companies with their own interests trying to sit down at a table and find some commonality. And most of the time that I think here in the US, that hasn't been proven to be effective. And so there's some challenges. You know, you mentioned the IAB and Project ReArc. I think it's very early days. Baseball analogy, it's the top of the first inning, if you will. And I think that initiative is trying to define itself before it can move forward with any of the tactical, steps required to find universal adoption, if you will. And so we're ways off here. But I think identity is, it was primed to be, I think, the most interesting topic in digital in 2020. I think that, you know, COVID may delay that a little bit here in the US. I think we're a little bit behind you guys in Europe in terms of, you know, not privacy is definitely something that is at the forefront of, you know, what 2020 strategy looks like for everyone. And, you know, obviously the deprivation of the cookie is a huge shift in market. But looking for universal currency right now feels incredibly fragmented. And, you know, if you're here in the US and you're trying to figure it out as a publisher, it's a big challenge. If you're trying to figure it out as a publisher that has traditional media roots, I think it's a bigger challenge. Because a lot of that is steeped in just sort of understanding and protecting and guarding your existing business rather than thinking about something in an innovative fashion the way that a digital first publisher might approach solving the same problem. And so, you know, I think when you start to think about desktop, mobile, broadcast, and how it all fits together, I think what you'll start to see here in the US is consortiums that come out of certain pockets or certain channels come together to try to solve. So you might find broadcasters come together to try to find a solution for, identity in the streaming space. And then you might find newspapers come together here in the US to try to figure out, you know, the desktop space. I've had some conversations around mobile. Everything we do at Ad Colony is focused on the in-app space. Today, that feels okay, right? The MAID, the IDFA, they're not affected. And personally, I don't believe that Google and Apple are going to change their policies on the MAID and the IDFA anytime soon. I could be wrong. I don't know anything that anyone else doesn't know. But, you know, identity is something that if you're not working at it and you're not trying to solve for it, then again, you're going to get left behind. And you're going to be falling asleep at the wheel. It is incredibly complex. I think if you were to survey 10 publishers here in the US, you'd probably get 10 different answers at this point.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you raise a couple of really interesting points there, Matt, not least of which is that final point that you made, that actually it's a complex problem for which in this instance probably sort of requires a slightly, not complicated, but not a simple, straightforward solution. And then the other point that you raised that I think is really interesting is how difficult it is actually to develop a reasonable collaboration and consortium amongst some businesses, because we know that, you know, publisher consortiums haven't worked very well, you know, prior to now. It's a little bit different now. We've got a few other consortiums popping up, particularly over here in Europe, you know, with the likes of Kieran, help me out. What are they called?
Ozone.
That's it. Thanks, Matt. Excuse my early Alzheimer's moment there. You got me distracted with the talk of Guns N' Roses, I'm afraid. I've, you know, catapulted back to the 80s, 90s. But so, you know, there's some examples of other consortiums, right, that are working on things a bit differently. But if you think about the first wave of consortiums, it became arguments over, whose businesses are more important. And, you know, you were looking at a bunch of businesses in the one room together trying to agree some basic principles, like potentially data sharing, which is always fraught with difficulties. And these are businesses that were competitors. So suddenly they have to have some shared interest. But now the landscape's a bit different. Mm. So I wonder if there's going to be an impetus to do things differently. And Kieran, I know you've got really strong opinions about the mobile space. So I'm interested to hear what you've got to say about that too.
About the mobile space?
Yeah, identity in an in-app environment.
Oh, okay. Well, I was just cutting across your thing about the co-ops. I think the fact there's no safety net anymore means that they're probably more inclined to work together in a stronger way, you know? That would be my opinion. And Ozone's kind of a different type of entity altogether. So it's kind of like, it's the first time the publishers have actually invested in a vehicle to sort of work on their behalf. And if anything, Ozone's sort of like the sort of walled garden for UK publishers. NetID is more of a shared identity, I guess. It's more of a sort of technology cohort. In terms of mobile, I mean, you could argue that I'd have to disagree with Matt on the sort of, I think that Google won't pull the ID, but I think Apple is the type of company that could do it at any time. I don't think they have any sort of, they've already proved that they're pretty anti anything relating to ID in advertising on their desktop and mobile web environment. So I wouldn't be surprised if they pulled the rug on app developers in the Apple ecosystem.
I mean, I'll give you my counter to that, which is the App Store.
Sure.
Right? The App Store is $50 to $75 billion a year business line for them, and that's not immaterial. And so to disrupt the developer ecosystem would disrupt a major chunk of change to their bottom line. And so it's very different, at least in my opinion, to the browser-based and the cookie conversation, which was a currency in the cookie that they inherited and they had to build their browser around, rather than an operating system that they inherently own and have developed. And so, again, your guess is as good as mine, but, you know, when you look at what the App Store means to both companies, right? I think there's an argument to be made for consistency and not for disruption.
So you're saying that Apple's motivated by money when it comes to privacy?
I plead the fifth, as we like to say.
No comments.
That Tim Cook's good sort of moral sense goes out the window when it comes to the almighty dollar bill, you know, the greenback.
I will say there's a fine line there that we all tiptoe.
He'll happily dine with probably the worst president of in the history of the United States, just if it could serve his own purpose. I agree with you. I think maybe that's a great counter argument. Maybe they'll water it down and say this is privacy, blah blah blah, but they'll keep it in place. I don't know.
Don't get me wrong. You know, I do believe there's grounds for concern, and you know, I do believe that there is the possibility, but I just, you know, my intuitively, my gut says, especially now when, you know, they're not moving as much hardware, that, you know, perhaps it's a more conservative approach and, you know, it's not disruptive.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point of view. And I guess sort of in summary on this news story where I was going earlier on was that I think nevertheless, you know, no matter what the challenges are, it's good to see some publishers doing something to strengthen their own business proposition, right? And gain control of that. So actually Axel Springer joining NetID is a real strength for that consortium and is probably only going to be something incredibly positive for Axel Springer and all the assets that they've got to bring to the table if it's focused on, you know, developing a single sign-on.
I think it's consistent with the theme today, right? Evolve or die.
Totally.
And, you know, I think that's where they're at.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that's a helpful segue to story three, which is really interesting, actually. US pharmacy retail chain CVS potentially developing their own ad network or media exchange. So this is, I suppose, somewhat, I wouldn't quite say hearsay. You know, it's an article that appeared in DigiDay this week, so it's obviously well-researched by the journalist that wrote it. But it's that they've not necessarily officially launched this. However, they are pitching it, apparently, into advertisers and agencies. So this is the ability to buy inventory via their own ad network. So that's for display inventory, but it's also for off-site placements using CVS data. So that's on Google and Facebook properties, including Instagram. They're also offering this as a fully managed service, and they're including tools like dynamic creative optimization. And the thing that's interesting about it is it's clearly CVS, you know, using the strength of their first party data, which is what they're gathering either on site or via their loyalty program, to package this up and offer it as a way to get advertisers, you know, and brands more interested in their inventory, and, you know, being able to access audience segments and to target in specific ways. So we've been talking over at least the last year, maybe even 18 months at ExchangeWire, about this notion of a kind of privacy first world giving rise to lots and lots of walled garden environments. And we've been saying that we could imagine how, brands could be developing their own walled garden environments, ecosystems, almost like e-commerce marketplaces. And I suppose you could look at this CVS example as a bit of both. It's a brand, but also they've got their own on-site marketplace, as it were, could be developing their own walled garden. And this seems like an example of that. What's your thoughts on that, Matt?
It's incredible because I think it's right time, right place. And so when I walk out of every morning, I live in Manhattan. You know, I'm fortunate in that I live in a very quiet neighborhood these days, but I go for a walk every morning around 7 a.m. just to get out of my flat, as you guys like to say. Mm-hmm. And the place where I feel most comfortable is the CVS on the corner because they have self-serve checkout. And
nice.
So, yeah. You know, I walk in there, right? I buy toilet paper, I buy essentials, and, you know, I'm in and out of there, but, you know, the one thing they get from me every time is my loyalty card. And so the amount of data that they have on me is probably incredible. And so when you think about, you know, the model and you talk about themes like in-housing, you know, maybe this is the next generation of in-housing, right? It's not just a revenue stream and the ability to drive media for other marketers, but, you know, it's really, again, coming back to the theme of reinvention, the opportunity for a traditional brick and mortar retailer to reinvent themselves in a digital first world. And so I think it's incredibly interesting.
Yeah, 100%. Kieron, you love this story, don't you?
I do. I think it's great. I think this is where ad tech has got to go, in the sense that the rise of these utility publishers, and I don't mean to call CVS a utility publisher, but the idea that a utility publisher, primarily their main business is not advertising. It's something else, and CVS is obviously a pharmacy or a chain of pharmacies. But they've just recognized they've got incredible data to build some really interesting scaled media business. And it's, you know, it might not be a massive you know, part of the revenue, but it's all upside. It's massive profit. It's free money, effectively, right? If you discount the expensive ad tech and staff you have to use, but even then, there's going to be more of this. The next decade is going to be about utility, first party data, and building business around that. And I think that you're going to see some really interesting businesses pop up that haven't even thought about. And the thing is, I think that the industry we're in is in a perpetual state of gloom and doom, because, you know, when you're trying to think your way out of a problem, it takes a lot of time before you can really have that realization to solve the problem. So you're all thinking about what's next, right? The cookie goes, what's next? The obvious companies are going away and the jobs aren't there. But it's at this stage where it's a great opportunity to step back and look around and see what's going to happen, right? So what's to say that Boots in the UK doesn't start something up here, or anybody who has really good first party data that can roll out a business? I mean, I'm very excited about the proposition of what's going to happen. I mean, it means there's going to be bigger problems for ad tech to solve. And one of those problems, if there's going to be thousands of these walled gardens, how the hell are you going to measure campaigns? How are you going to build attribution models around this? And these are the things that ad tech can do really well.
Sorry, I didn't mean to jump in, but I think what's really interesting here is the marriage of ad tech and the retailer, right? And the fact that the retailer, will they dive into ad tech to become, you know, perhaps buy some distressed assets in this market, or will they build on top of existing ad tech? And is that the opportunity, Kerr?
I think, Matt, that could well be the scenario. Or there'll be, I hate to use the word refugees, but there'll be a lot of ad tech refugees that are looking for good people, looking for a home to build the next wave of technology in the marketing space. And the raw materials aren't going to be JavaScript on page. The raw materials are going to be first party data. Those will be the building blocks for the next wave of good businesses. And I think that we're going to see this. I think you're right, Matt. This sort of hybrid of ad tech and retail, or maybe ad tech and first party data. It doesn't necessarily have to be retail. It could easily be app related or even online related, like logged in data. But I think we're going to see some really interesting businesses pop up, and they're not very obvious right now because, you know, we're going through this sort of distressed period for the industry, because we've sort of become addicted to the double click cookie in many ways, and it's now trying to wean it off, and there's a lot of people kind of looking for the next gig. But that will encourage a lot of businesses, a lot of people to kind of start their own thing. I'm seeing loads of ad networks popping up now. Not your typical horizontal ad network or an ad network built off programmatic, which really was just arbitrage, but actually people building vertical ad networks where they aggregate a bunch of publishers, they work on a first party basis, they build unique ad units or a unique marketing story, and they're getting budget because the budget's there, whether it's at the holding groups or the independents or wherever, it's there, right? Because I'm telling you now, 100% of the spend is not going to Facebook and Google. That will never fucking happen, right? Despite what the doomsayers are saying and all the rest of it. It's never going to happen. There'll always be 20 or 30% or maybe more. Who knows? Google and Facebook's control over the ecosystem is going to decrease as well, because they depend on third-party cookies to knit all that stuff together, right? As a standalone, Google is pretty strong. It's pretty strong. So is Facebook. But they do not control all the attention on the web, right? Because people are on TikTok, people are on Snap, people are on CTV, people are on gaming. They're all over the place. And those two companies do not have complete dominance. They do in the respect of traditional sort of digital display, right, in that respect. But they don't have complete and utter control. And we're going to see another interesting sort of play here. Huawei, who have been obviously ostracized from the American market, but they are absolutely huge. they're going to build their own ecosystem. So there's a whole new ad tech ecosystem, right, to be built there. And I think that's bloody exciting. Like, you know what I mean? I think the stories, if you have this persistent, gloomy view of the war, or view of the industry, then you need to get out of it. Because, or if you're a cookie zealot, then you need to leave the industry, because those two types of things are going to go away. But if you
but replaced by other opportunity, right?
Yeah, it's not obvious. I mean, you'll get the IME trying to build a universal ID, but that's never going to happen. There's going to be so many different bits, and I don't think it's down to it. I think it's going to be a commercial organization that builds around this. And we are seeing some companies like InfoSum are creating a lot of waves. Paramount are creating a lot of waves. There's a bunch of other companies creating some interesting stuff around identity, and they'll be part of the solution, but not the overall solution. There won't be a universal solution.
No, but that's what's interesting about the CVS example, right? Is that you're starting to see people that have got the sort of the ability, the power, the skill, the ability, or whatever. So in this example, it's a retailer with some really strong first party data, actually just embracing that and going for it, developing their own ad network and their own advertising offering, and seeing how far they can go with it. And, you know, they're actually not the first to have done it either, but it's a good example and it's a good time to be doing it as well. There's so much to talk about on this topic, but in the interest of time, I am going to move us on, but this is somewhat connected. Matt, we usually, you know, wind up the conversation of our news stories with just a bit of a focus on our special guest. And, there isn't anyone in the ad tech world at the moment that isn't talking about gaming. So maybe you can just give us a little bit of a whistle-stop tour of Ad Colony's perspective at the moment. Gaming's an enormous opportunity. There's an audience there that's unreached by many advertisers that perhaps don't understand the value of it. What are some of the big things that you're focusing on at the moment, or that you're working on at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really exciting time for us, and that almost feels guilt-provoking to say, but, you know, gaming is seeing this massive uptick. And so, you know, we've looked and we've done some surveying and research, and, you know, we've seen stats that Verizon reported a 75% increase in gaming usage week over week in the month of March, as people are starting to, socially distance and isolate at home. It's to Kieran's point earlier, the in-app space historically has been driven largely by the performance space. And so, you know, as a company, Ad Colony is really fortunate in that we have a diversified offering. We built programmatic infrastructure about 5 years ago to really dive deep with holding companies and to help them to better understand the in-app space, and more specifically gaming. And so we've done a really good job over the past couple of years in educating brands and marketers and technology providers like DSPs on the benefits and values of gaming as a channel and as an alternative to traditional broadcast, for example, when it comes to video. And rewarded video is a huge part of the gaming experience. We've built display functionality so that, you know, again, if an advertiser just wants to run banners, we give them a marketplace at scale to be able to do so. So when we look at the composition of our business, we've got a huge SDK footprint that sits in a significant, you know, majority of the top 1,000 apps in the App Store, largely gaming. And, you know, what we're seeing is that we're seeing brands continue to spend and actually spend more in gaming today, because that's where they can reach their target audience, whereas they might not want to be in something like news, unfortunately. We're seeing that the performance space just sees this organic uptick in growth because people are searching for more games to play. There are certain categories that are just kind of on fire right now. Board games, for example, hyper-casual games, card games. People are spending a lot more time with their phone in their hand, perhaps even while they're watching Netflix or the news. And, you know, they are engaging in some type of gaming experience. So, you know, we've seen that amongst the, you know, the respondents to our survey, like 50% of users say their mobile usage outside of the workplace has gone up significantly. A third of users are playing multiple games per day. And, you know, I think they're seeing positive sentiment towards the marketers who continue to share their messaging during this time of sensitivity.
It's so interesting because I feel like that's also a little bit of a description of how my life has changed a little bit since lockdown, which is that I'm gaming and I'm maybe hyper-casual games, and maybe I did a bit of hyper-casual gaming before, but not much because I never really felt like I had time. And now I'm driven to it much more. And it's not even that I feel like I've got that much more time. It's just that there's no other sort of sociable options to hand that there was before lockdown. So in the absence of less kind of face-to-face interaction, I'm finding myself driven to hyper-casual gaming. And so what I'm noticing is that the ads that I'm getting served in and around that are so much more sophisticated than they used to be, which tells me that the advertisers that are getting into that space are getting maybe a little more confident and a little more mainstream, which is great to see.
Yeah, to that point, I think social isolation doesn't have to mean social deprivation. And so, you know, mobile gaming provides a sense of community when we're all social distancing, right? And apps have features like real-time chat to allow users to connect with one another. And, you know, I think gaming offers that safe haven, right? It's an environment to escape from the craziness of your day. The phone is your most personal device by far, right? We carry it with us wherever we go. And it offers creative capabilities that you don't get with standard video on a TV or via YouTube, right? You can use creative smartly to include capabilities like haptic or the gyroscope and drive a far more engaging user experience, which makes advertising really kind of fun and interesting rather than dull and kind of bland with what you get in most broadcast experiences. So, you know, not to play favorites and not to say I'm biased, by any means, of course I am. But I think, you know, the creative experience in mobile is far cooler and far more advanced. And hopefully that's where, you know, you end up with things like OTT and CTV down the road. But, you know, I like to make the case that mobile video is today everything that OTT aspires to be down the road. It's addressable by nature. It's brand safe. You've got all of these like protective mechanisms in place, like viewability and IVT vendors who, you know, ensure that it's, you know, really kind of up to snuff and that, you know, advertisers are getting what they think they're getting and staying away from scandal and potential nefarious, you know, environments.
Yeah. There's so much more to talk about on this, but we've run out of time. So I'm going to wind it up there. Thank you very much, Kieran.
Thank you, Rachel. Thank you, Matt. Thank you for your
time.
Thank
you so much, guys.
Great to chat with you, Matt. Always a pleasure.
Right. Hopefully we'll see you. We'll see you over this side of the water when all this madness dies down.
You know, if I have to take a boat over, I'll do what I've got to do.
But, and we also
I really appreciate the time.
No worries. And we also know what your karaoke song's going to be if we find ourselves in a karaoke bar with you.
You've got a deal. Next time we'll do this in person and we'll do a podcast and a karaoke sing along. And then, you know, now that I know that Kieran's on TikTok, maybe we can dance a little too.
Like it. Let's do
it. I'm not on TikTok.
Thanks very much.
And house party.
This week. Thanks very much. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.